There we go.
Thank you. So thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you everybody to be here tonight. I know that there's something else happening. Perhaps the Blue Jays will make history tonight. But before that, we will speak about another part of Canada's history, what happened during the Second World War, mainly in Montreal, and also some of the things here at McMaster. So not a lot of people know that parallel to the Manhattan Project that we hear a lot about, there was another project on the atomic bomb, which was called Tube Alloys. It was the nickname of the project. It started before the Manhattan Project. It started in 1940 in England. It was the British project on the nuclear bomb. And first I will show you the different topics that we will cover tonight. So where does the Montreal laboratory came from? There were three laboratories in Europe where people moved to Montreal to work on the atomic project: Paris, Cambridge, and Rome. Then I will talk briefly about the history of the laboratory. And I did a 14-year research, so I was working at the same time, but during my part time, on people. I was interested in the stories of people who had worked in Montreal during the war, and I found that there were a lot of women that were involved, and it had not been noted or written about before, so I will talk to you about that. Then there's an important link between McMaster and the Montreal Laboratory. Harry Thode was an employee of, it was the Canadian Research Council that was the head of the Montreal Laboratory. He moved for 1 year to Montreal and then came back here, and I will talk about that. Then there are other things, if we have time to cover. There are spies stories that happened in Montreal during the war. And for because we're here at an engineering university, I'd like to talk also about some of the important engineering problems that were solved during the war. And then what happened after the war? Someone came before the talk and asked me, is there a link between Chalk River and Montreal Laboratory? And I said, yes. So we will talk about this. So at the just before the beginning of the Second World War, 1939, there was an important discovery that was made in Germany about nuclear fission. So when a uranium atom is bombarded with a neutron, it can break apart in two portions. And that was not known before 1939. And that discovery has a big impact on the war. It was published in open literature in 1939. It was the discovery was made at the beginning of 1939, and the publication, I think, was around beginning of June. The war, as you probably know, started in September. Then many people, when they learned about this, the fission, and were working already, you know, on atomic projects, understood that there was a possibility of a chain reaction that could produce power, on one hand power, or an explosion. But there were still a lot of things that were not known. Soon after the beginning of the war, there was the Allied decided that they will stop publishing any research that they were doing on nuclear. So there were three labs that are in Europe that were very important. The first one, it's also, here we have three people the person at the left is Hans Halban, is Lev Kovarsky. I say Lev because his name, he was originally Russian, moved to Germany, and that's the way, and then to France, where he worked with Hans Halban and Frédéric Joliot-Curie, which is the spouse of Irène Curie, the daughter of Marie and Pierre Curie. And they were one of the most advanced laboratories at the time on nuclear fission at the beginning of the war. And during 1939, 1940, before France was invaded by Germany, they continued working, and they noticed something that still has an impact here to this day, is that there is something that we call a moderator. It's a substance that will slow down neutrons so that it can be more efficiently absorbed by uranium and produce fission. So an important moderator is heavy water. You probably have heard just now. And so heavy water is part of ordinary water. The difference is, you know, heavy water, normal water is H2O, so two hydrogen and one oxygen. Heavy water is D2O, so it's deuterium, two atoms of deuterium. Deuterium is a kind of hydrogen. It's hydrogen is the simplest element. It's one proton and one electron around. And deuterium is one proton plus one neutron in the nucleus. That's the only difference. So because it's two particles in the nucleus, it's heavier than normal hydrogen. So D2O is heavier than H2O. So that's why we call it heavy water. It's a very, very tiny part of normal water, but you can extract it, purify it from normal water. It's not an easy process, but it's possible to do it. And at the beginning of the war, there was only one place in the world where heavy water was produced. It was an ammonia plant in Norway, in Vemork. It's in southern Norway, but not close to the ocean. And it was a byproduct, heavy water, and it was, but they produced it because they were able to sell it to chemists and physicists who were doing experiments. At the time when it was produced, there was no practical application for heavy water other than research. And in 1940, there was 85 kilograms of heavy water worldwide, and they were all in that place in Norway. So if we come back here, Frédéric Joliot, the man at the right, understood that this would be a very important resource for fission, for nuclear power. And he talked to the French secret services and sent agents in Norway. And Norway at the time was still neutral. It was before Germany invaded Norway. So they went there and they talked to the owner of the plant, and they bought, because for them it was hard to sell. They had too many heavy water. People were buying it only by grams. Now someone came, wanted to buy the whole stock of 85 kilos. So they did that, and they moved it to France without the Germans. There were Germans there that were looking at them, but they did something, and they were able to take all the heavy water back to France, to Paris, where Halban and Kovarsky and Joliot-Curie worked on it. And when the Germans invaded France, they moved the Paris laboratory first to Clermont-Ferrand, which is a bit south or in the middle of France. And They thought that the Germans would stay just on the northern part of France. But then when they saw that they were coming all the way, they evacuated, I don't know, yeah, they evacuated all the uranium and the heavy water that they had. They crossed France from the center, from the middle to the west coast in Bordeaux, where the heavy water and most of the scientists that were working with Joliot Curie boarded this ship, the SS Boom Park. As you see, it has suffered something from the war. But they were able, like one day before the Germans arrived in Bordeaux, to board and to cross the channel and to go to England. So all the heavy water, some of the equipment, and several scientists who were working with Joliot Curie went to Cambridge, UK. Joliot Curie himself didn't go. His wife, Irène Curie, was sick at the time. They had two children, so he decided to stay in France, and he eventually joined the resistance in France and worked during the war for the resistance. And so the heavy water and the scientists went to Cambridge, to the Cavendish Laboratory. And there's another link with Montreal and Canada, because for a long time, the head of the Cavendish Lab was Ernest Rutherford, that you see here with the sign, "Talk softly, please." You can see that the safety measures were not exactly the same that we have now with all these, the hanging. But it was another laboratory that was on the top laboratory, top research on atomic. It's where the neutron was discovered, 1932. And Rutherford in 1940, he was not there, was deceased, but he had worked, and we see him at the right at McGill University in Montreal, where he had worked on, was one of the first to work on radioactivity. He was the one who discovered that radioactivity is in fact a transmutation of one element into another element. So that was his big discovery that he did at McGill. And so Halban and Kovarsky and their family and the heavy water arrived in Cambridge near the middle of 1940, while there was the war, when Germany was thinking about invading perhaps Britain and were sending planes and bombarding London and other big cities in England. There, Halban and Kovarsky had their own lab and continued to work on fission. During the same years, there was another group which they called themselves the Via Panisperna Boys. It's so the person at the right is Fermi, Enrico Fermi, who has made many important discoveries, was the one who was hired by the Manhattan Project and was the first one to start a nuclear reactor. And it was a street in Rome, Panisperna Street, Via Panisperna. That's why they were called this. And among these gentlemen, two of them worked for the Manhattan Project. Where is the... Ah, here. And so Fermi and him, and this gentleman also moved to Canada during the war and worked at Laval University in Quebec City as a physics teacher. And he was not finally hired by the Montreal lab because he was asking for too high a salary and they couldn't pay him. And there's another person very important who is not on the photo but who took the picture. It's Bruno Pontecorvo. He was the youngest of the group. And he, Fermi, his wife, was Jewish. So when the racial laws were passed in Italy, he decided to leave and to, it's also the year he won the Nobel Physics Prize. So he went with his family in Sweden to collect the prize and then never went back to Italy for all his life. He immigrated to the United States and stayed there. And Pontecorvo was also Jewish, and he understood very early that it would not be good for him to stay in Italy, so he moved to France in 1934 and worked with the Joliot Curie and in this group. So, but he stayed in Paris until a day before the Germans invaded Paris, and with a group of other people, they cycled from Paris to Toulouse, and then eventually to Portugal, and he took a boat in Lisbon, like several people did, and moved to United States, eventually worked in Montreal. So these three labs, a lot of scientists from these three labs eventually came to Montreal. So why Montreal? The thing is that in 1941, a group of scientists in the UK, most of them refugees, showed that it was possible to build a bomb, to have two mass of uranium. If they go together, there will be a very strong explosion. But there would be a lot of work. And the first thing is that uranium, natural uranium that we found in the ground, is made of mostly two isotopes. We see two kinds of uranium, uranium-238 and 235. And only one of the two is fissile. One of the two can have fission when it's bombarded with neutron. And it's 235, and it makes only 0.7% of natural uranium. So if you want to make a uranium bomb, you have to separate 235 from 238. And because it's the same element, it's not possible to do it chemically. You cannot do it with, you know, ordinary chemistry reactions that people knew at the time. So you have to find another way, and it's not that easy. It took a long time to do it. And then they also discovered during the war that when uranium fission, uranium-235 fissions, uranium-238 can absorb a neutron and change eventually into plutonium, which one of the sort of plutonium is also fissile. So you can make, there was another path to making an atomic bomb, was the plutonium bomb. In a certain sense, they found that it was easier, or thought that it was easier, the plutonium bomb, because it's a different element from uranium. And it's created inside the uranium rod. Let's say you have a rod and a lot of uranium. So you can chemically separate uranium and plutonium, and then you can have plutonium and perhaps, because it's not easy, but perhaps make a bomb. So in 1942, they had this idea that there is two paths to make a bomb. Oh yes, and the other thing I wanted to say is that why they started on this and why they put so much money on producing an atomic bomb. They were convinced that the Germans were working on it. So they were afraid that Germany would have an atomic bomb before the Allies. And that could have changed completely the war. And the reason why they thought that is because they were really very good atomic scientists in Germany, labs, a lot of resources. They had invaded Norway where they could have a heavy water plant. They had access to uranium. So there was a lot of things that made them think that they could be on a atomic bomb development. Then, because of the bombardments in UK and the difficulty, you know, with finding people to work on this specific project, which was not a high priority for UK, they were barely surviving the bombardments. So they thought that it would be better if they could move the project from Cambridge to another location. Initially, United States. They thought United States, but it didn't work out for different political reasons. Then they asked Canada. And the first location was Ottawa. They thought to put it in Ottawa, but because of the presence of all the embassies, they thought that perhaps there will be more spies in Ottawa than elsewhere. That was really the thinking. So they said, and also Montreal at the time was the biggest, the most industrial city in the country. So they moved the project to Montreal, and Montreal University had just been built on the mountain, what we call in Montreal the mountain. It's a hill really, but, and you can see what it looked like. Now it's completely different nowadays, but, and it was not fully occupied. So the project, and in Canada, it was a joint Canadian and British project. So it was under both the Canadian National Research Council and its British equivalent. And they rented one of this part here was rented by the tube alloys project. And that became the Montreal lab. Initially, there were about 100 people who moved from Cambridge to Montreal, but at the height of the project, 400 people worked. If we count everybody, you know, in Montreal and here and also in Toronto, some people in Toronto and in Ottawa. It looks big. At the time, it was the biggest ever scientific project in Canada. But if we compare to the Manhattan Project, it's very small. The Manhattan Project, who started in just after Pearl Harbor, at the height they had 100,000 employees. So it's like another completely different level. That's why they were able to produce the bomb during the war. In Montreal, they knew in 1942 that they couldn't make the bomb during the war, but they wanted to advance the project as much as possible. So they had, I think I have it, yeah. So they had two objectives given to the Montreal Laboratory. First was to design and build a heavy water nuclear reactor that at the time they called a pile. And also to devise a way to separate plutonium from irradiated uranium rods. So that was the two main objectives. There were other objectives. They did also some work on health, on radioisotopes for medicine, and that's one of the outcomes of the Montreal Laboratory. They had big problems. It started at the end of 1942. But the first year, the whole year of 1943, started a lot of different projects, but they were lacking resources, mainly uranium and heavy water, mostly because they were all bought by the Americans. At the time in Canada, the uranium mines were private, and it was, they existed before the war. It was not for uranium. Uranium was a waste from the mine. They were looking for radium. Radium is inside uranium. It's a product of the decay of uranium. So they had this small amount of radium and these big, big piles of uranium that they didn't know what to do with. And then the Americans were much quicker than the Canadians, and they came to see the El Dorado Mining, which was the company who was owning the biggest mines. And they said, "Why? What would you say if I buy everything? All these waste, you know, that you have, we will buy them." So they did that. And at the time, it was in the Northwest Territories. The big mines were in the Northwest Territories, and they transported a lot of uranium to the United States. They also bought most of the uranium they bought came also from Congo, which was a Belgium colony during the war. And there was a Belgian expatriate who was living in the States, in New York, and had crossed the Atlantic with tons of uranium because he had heard that it would perhaps, you know, be of value. So he sold all the uranium to the Manhattan Project. That's the uranium that was used for Hiroshima and in most reactors came from the Congo. And the Americans, because the project in 1943, the Manhattan Project, was very big and going very well, they did not want to collaborate really with the Montreal Laboratory. So most of the research were kind of as halt in the summer of 1943 in Montreal. They were able to find solutions to these problems. The first one was at the Quebec Conference, 1943. So you see Churchill, Mackenzie King, and Roosevelt. And Roosevelt and Churchill, during that conference, they had a lot of things to discuss, but they signed a secret agreement on nuclear research. So it was a collaboration between the Tube Alloys project in Montreal and some still in the UK and the Manhattan Project. So it gave access to uranium and heavy water to the Montreal group. And here we see Mackenzie King is there, but he was allowed only in the photo, in the pictures. When they met, they met in separate rooms, and he was not allowed in the real talks. He was just the host of the conference. But the Americans had said that, yes, they want to collaborate with the Montreal Laboratory, but they thought that there were too many foreigners. Approximately half of the scientists who were in Montreal were refugees who had fled the Germany and other countries, Italy, etc. So the Americans were a bit, still at the time, they were not really happy with too many foreigners. So they said, we want a Canadian or a British as director of the lab, of the Montreal lab. Until the end of 1943, it was Hans Halban, the man that we saw in the first picture. He was also Jewish, from Austrian origin. He was from a background in nobility. His grandfather had the title von Halban, which was given by the emperor of Austria at the time. But during the war, Hans Halban left the von because it was linked to Germany and Austria, so he was named only Hans Halban. But he had a lot of difficulty to work with a lot of people. You know, he was the kind of director who says things and do not necessarily listen a lot to the people under him. So there was a lot of problems also in the lab because of that. But he was a very, very good scientist, and he was a very good planner. He started the lab he arrived in Montreal, and there was nothing, you know. He was able to move everything from England, start and hire people and set up the lab. That's a big work. But in beginning of 1944, he was replaced. Yeah, so we see here there's an official photo. That's, if you search on internet, Montreal lab, 1944, that's the photo that you will see. It was one of the only photos that we used to see. So a lot of people here. So that's Hans Halban is here, and his replacement, John Cockcroft, here, and other people we will talk about. Alan Nunmay is this guy. Bruno Pontecorvo, the one who took the photo from the Panisperna boys, is this man. Here is Pierre Demers, is the only French-Canadian really who worked in the Montreal lab. He was also in the Joliot-Curie group. Many French were there. Bertrand Goldschmidt was there, Jules Guéron, a lot of people. And until this photo, I thought, seeing this photo, that only men had worked in the Montreal lab when you look at this. So the Americans requested a Canadian or a British, and it was John Cockcroft, a British man who was named head of the Montreal lab. And he stayed in Canada until 1946. He was also the first director of the Chalk River Laboratory. After Montreal, he moved to Chalk River. After the war, he won the Nobel Physics Prize for what we see here. It's one of the first particle accelerators that was built in the 1930s. So Cockcroft-Walton accelerator. And as you see, these are pictures that were sent by the family of Dr. Cockcroft. His son that we see here, that's in Montreal in 1945. He had five children, four girls and one son. His son is still alive, and I had several conversations with him. And so they moved to Montreal in 1944, and then they moved to Chalk River at end of 1945. So it was quite different from living in Cambridge in the UK. But he was a man who was really involved with the people in the lab, and people liked him very much. And he also did, as you see here, skiing. That photo is in Sainte-Adèle, Quebec, where he went during some weekends to ski with his older daughter. So the nomination of Cockcroft changed quite a bit, and also the collaboration with the American, and also the access to the resources. So starting in 1944 until the end of the war, there was a lot of work that was accomplished. And I will talk a bit about later. At the same time, okay, in the first picture, there were three men, Joliot Curie, Hans Halban, who was the first director, and Lev Kovarsky, that we see here. He was originally from Russia and moved with his father when he was young to Germany, and then in the 30s, because also they were Jewish, moved to France. But he never was a real research. He was, but never did, work in, like the others, went to do a PhD or things like that. He succeeded by working part-time and studying part-time to become an electrical engineer. But he was hired by Joliot Curie in Collège de France at their lab there. And he was an incredible researcher. So Joliot Curie allowed him to work as an equal to Halban as a researcher, even if he didn't have a PhD at the time. So there was a kind of rivalry between Halban and Kovarsky. And when Halban was named director and the project moved to Montreal, Kovarsky decided that he would not work under Halban. So he stayed in Cambridge until the summer of 1944. So Cockcroft succeeded in convincing Kovarsky to come to Montreal. And he said, because I said the first objective of the lab was to build a nuclear reactor. But they started big. They had this idea of building a very big reactor, the biggest in the world at the time when they started the design. And then Cockcroft said, why don't we build something much smaller, kind of an experiment? Then we can try, you know. And then he gave Kovarsky this project. He was head of the project of the small reactor, which was later called the ZEEP, Zero Energy Pile. In a little more than a year, in a year and 1 month, Kovarsky and his team designed and built and commissioned a nuclear reactor in about 13 months. And it was built in Chalk River. I'll show a picture later. And it was the second country where a nuclear reactor was operated, was commissioned, was Canada during the war, just before the end of the war. So Kovarsky moved to Montreal with his family. We see him here with his wife and daughter, Irene Kovarsky. She is still alive. She became a computer scientist, one of the first women to be a computer scientist. She lives in France. They moved to France, moved back to France after the war, and Kovarsky was one of the founder of CERN, the big research center near Geneva, between France and Switzerland. So Kovarsky, with Cockcroft and all the team, they did a lot of work at the time. And when I did my research several years ago, I had access to different archives. Most of the archives are in UK, in London. We have also some in Ottawa, in Montreal. And I had the list of employees. I was able to have a list of employees. And when I received the list of employees, I saw a lot of name of women. And I said, but who are these these women? I had never heard that women had worked in the project. And so I started to search on the internet with the name of the women to see if some were still alive, or even some men were that had worked in Montreal during the war. And I was able to find two women, now is deceased, but two women about 10 years ago that had worked in Montreal during the war. One of them is here, Alma Chaket. She is a chemist. She is still alive. She is 108 years old. She lived in her own house until last year. So, and she still has all her memory and everything, an incredible memory. And when I was finally able to find her, or actually her daughter, and I had only a real address, a house address, I wrote a letter, sent it by mail, normal mail. And then about 2 weeks later, I received an email. I had left my email saying, oh yes, it's true. My mother, Alma Chaket, worked in Montreal and she talks about it often. And then the next day, they said, we have about 15 pictures from Montreal. And one of them is this one, the chemistry division of the Montreal lab in the summer of 1945. So when I saw, you know, on my computer the picture, I said, wow, you know, all these women also, about 25% of the employees of the chemistry division were women, and several of them scientists. They were not all, some of them were secretaries, but several of them. So we see Alma. Oh, it's not working anymore. Anyway, and just on her, when we look for us on the right is her husband and several people that were really important in the lab. In the middle It's Friedrich Panet was the director of the chemistry division. He had a long career. He was an Austrian also, but left before the war and worked in England and was the head of a big lab in England. So I started to do a bit of more research on the women. So here you can see Alma Chaquette in her Montreal apartment in 1945. And when I went, she's living in Wales now. I went to meet her and to interview her in 2019. So you can see her, she was 101 at the time. So it was a really privilege to meet her and to be able. So a part of the book that I've written, there's a part based on my interview with her and the story. And also, yes, the other thing I wanted to say that she could remember, like when I contacted her, about half, the name of half of the people in this picture. So she's really quite incredible. And then I started to receive, I published a few articles in the Canadian Nuclear Society built in about women who worked in Montreal during the war. And I received other people sending me stories of their, most of them their mother that had worked. And yeah, and then the other person who was still alive in 2019 was Joan Wilkie Heal. So she was, here we see it's a portrait, a drawing done by a friend of her family in Montreal when she was 16 years old. And it's at that age that she was hired in the Montreal lab. She was completing 12th grade, and she was good in math. So they were looking for people, and especially women, who were good in math to be computers. There were no digital computers at that time. They were real persons doing calculations all day long. And they needed that to do different calculations for the size of the reactor and a lot of things. So she was the first one to be hired at the Montreal lab. In total, there were approximately six computers. For the Manhattan Project, it was much bigger, like more than 100 women worked as computers. Perhaps some of you have seen the movie about the women, yeah, that worked for NASA. That was in the 60s, end of 50s, beginning of the 60s. But this was way before. It was in the 40s. So the idea of the people at the time is that women were better at detailed calculations than men. And so that's why they hired mostly women. And they were good because they did some calculations, and when they started the reactor, it worked. And it was based on calculations that most of it was done by hand, or they had small machines, not only by hand, but still they had no computers to do all these calculations at the time. And another person who was very important in the lab is Jean Le Cayne. We see her here with her husband. She was born in Port Archer, which is now part of Thunder Bay. Yeah, part of Thunder Bay. And she is not at all from a family where her mother was at home, and her father was selling things, you know, house by house. They had no scientist or mathematician, but she was very, very gifted. So she was able to have a scholarship to go to Queen's University in Kingston, where she did her bachelor and master degree under 3 years. So, and then she applied for another scholarship at the time that were given to women who wanted to do PhD in Europe, but it was 1939. So she asked the permission, she had the scholarship, but she asked the permission to do her PhD in the US. So she went to Harvard. She did a mathematics PhD, but at the time Harvard didn't give any diploma to women. She had to enroll in a women university, but she, all her courses and teachers and everything were in Harvard. So she was one of the first women to have a PhD in mathematics at Harvard or the sister university of Harvard. And there she met her husband, Mr. Agnew. What's his first name? I don't remember, but he was also doing his PhD, but in history. But when the Americans declared war to Japan, he enrolled and he was sent to the Pacific Theater about 2 weeks after they married. And they were separated for 27 months. And that's after 27, that's when they were reunited at the end of the war, after 27 months. So Jean said, I want to help for the war and I want to help my country. So she moved back to Canada, to Ottawa. And then she was hired by the Montreal Laboratory as a mathematician. And with other mathematicians, she developed the basics of the neutronic science. And there are still some of her work. It's not in use anymore because it's old, but it forms the basis of the work that is still in use in Canada and elsewhere. And she, after the war, they moved back to the United States and she became a mathematics teacher at university. And she won twice the best teacher award of the US during her career. And they had five children. And she was able to do all this, you know, at the same time. She never, there were no kindergarten or places to keep the children. So she hired the neighbors and all this, but she was able to do it. And their five children are still alive. I have a lot of contact with them. So, and I hope that one day someone will write a book about her because I think she's very special. She wrote a small biography about like 15 pages that what she did in her life, and it's very beautifully written also. She had many talents. And then another people sent me another photo taken in 1945, the experimental physics division. Okay, now it's working. So here in the middle, we see Alan Nunmey. He was the head of the experimental physics division. I'll talk about him a bit later. Again, we see many women. Some of them, she became an astronomer. Some of them had really long careers. You see, we see also Kowarski, Lev Kowarski, who did the Zeep reactor, was wow. There, and a lot of these people and also Bruno Pontecorvo, the man from Italy. A lot of these people after the war went back to university and became physics or chemistry teachers. Okay, now the link between the Montreal Laboratory and McMaster. Harry Thode was a chemistry researcher and professor at McMaster at the beginning of the war. And I will show it here. And with his group, they built a mass spectrometer. We see a part of it. So it's a device, it's an experimental apparatus that you can use to separate isotopes of the same element. Like what I was talking about, uranium-235 and 38, the difference between the two is the mass. So with a mass spectrometer, you can separate and do experiments and make precise measurements of each separate isotope. And when you have a uranium rod and you put it in a nuclear reactor, there is a lot of different fish, a lot of fish in it. It produces a lot of different elements that are, most of them are radioactive. And in order to build a nuclear reactor, you need a precise photo or idea of what is exactly in the irradiated rod, because some of the products will absorb neutrons and things like that. So you need to have a way to separate and measure the different elements. And there was a very few places in the world where you could do that. And McMaster in 1943 was one of them. So CNRC started to have discussions with Professor Thoud, and they proposed him to join the Montreal lab, and even to move to Montreal. So he accepted to join the lab, but he insisted in having a separate group at McMaster because of the mass spectrometer. So they reached an agreement. They had to take leave from university. He was detached from McMaster for a few years during the war and was paid by the National Research Council. But he spent approximately a year in Montreal working and knowing all the people. And also there was a lot of collaboration between the Montreal lab and the Chicago lab. The Chicago lab, that's where it was the first nuclear reactor was started by Fermi. So Thoud went there also and worked there for a while. And then in 1944, in 1944, he came back to McMaster and had a group. Yeah, something that also I want to say is that when they worked in Montreal in the separate, it was separate from the rest of the university. The RCMP was there guarding the doors, and they were not allowed to speak to other people in university. And it was the same here at McMaster. So when they established this group, they were 8 people officially. I think in reality they were more than that, but officially only 8 people working in the Montreal McMaster group of the Montreal lab. So they were not allowed to speak to other people at university about their work. Everything was secret. Everybody who joined the Montreal lab had to sign a paper saying that they will not even speak to their spouse about what is happening during the day. They could not, and not only for a few years, for the rest of their life. That's what it was written. They were to keep everything secret. So it was a bit of a challenge, what I understand here at McMaster, because it was not like a separate space. They had also other researchers, so the RCMP was there, not there, and there are some funny stories that were told by Thoud and other people about that period at McMaster, where they were under surveillance by the RCMP. Another person who is there that we see at right is Henry Duckworth. He was also working with Thoud. He was also a chemist. He has also, after the war, a long career as a chemistry professor, and then even higher in the university. And there is a story about him in the Montreal lab, because all these people also came to Montreal to work with other researchers. There was quite a lot of travel during the war. And Duckworth, in his memories when he was in his 70s, wrote some stories about the Montreal lab, that 2 people had been irradiated with lethal doses. One time when he visited the Montreal lab, and he wrote, it's in my book, quite a detailed story, and it looks really credible when I read it first. But the 2 people he talked about that had received supposedly the lethal dose, they lived 40 years after the war. So probably it was a bit of an exaggeration by him. But this to say that the protection and the safety measures were not exactly the same as we have now. There were some incidents at the Montreal lab, and some radioactive material was spread, especially in the chemistry lab. But no, a lot of people, and as I said about Alma Chaket, a lot of people lived very long, especially the women who worked in the laboratory. I did the math, and the average age at death of all the women I could trace back that worked in the lab, it's 89 years old. So it's very high. So I don't know if a small amount of radiation could be good for you. Then the other stories that was very, very big in the news at the time in 1946 when it came out was that there was a Russian or a Soviet spy in the Montreal lab, Alan Nunmay. And I see here Igor Guzenko. Igor Guzenko was a clerk working at the Soviet embassy in Ottawa, and he was responsible for sending coded messages. So he was responsible for coding the messages and sending them by letter to Moscow. And in 1945, near the end, when they knew that the war would end, he received his notice that he would go back to Russia. And he had been living with his family, his wife and two children in Ottawa for 3 years, and he liked it there. So he didn't want to go back. So he took a very difficult decision, but he decided to leave the office, the embassy, with a lot of documents that were protected, that were secret documents from the Russian embassy, the Soviet embassy. And he went to the Foreign Affairs Ministry in Ottawa and said, I have a lot of information that perhaps will interest you. Among those, a list of people who are spying for Russia, for the Soviet Union in Canada. And a lot of them were scientists in several projects. And one of the biggest one was Alan Nunmay. He was a British man who was member of the Communist Party in Cambridge when he was a student in the 30s. But he was not alone. There was quite a number of young people at the time who were, after the First World War, quite a lot. The Communist Party in Europe were quite big. But he played, when he joined the Tubaloys project in England, in Cambridge, he was contacted by Soviets, by the Soviet embassy, and he was, they asked him if he could give them some information. They didn't never use the word spying, saying that they were allies, and perhaps it would be good that everybody, you know, share information with everybody. He thought about it. And he said, at the beginning, he didn't say yes, but he left his address, a way to contact him. So when he was moved to Montreal, and when it became clear that the Germans would not win the war and would not build the bomb, they contacted him again, the Soviet embassy, and he decided that it would be good if it was not only the Americans who would have the bomb. So he decided to give information, but he had signed all the papers and he knew that it was contrary to everything that he had signed. So he did that for 2 years before being caught, before Guzenko left the embassy. That was September 5, 1945, that Guzenko came. And when they had this list and they saw his name, he was head of the physics department, so he was like, everybody had a lot of confidence on him. They were very surprised. They thought, you know, it's like British thought that all British gentlemen would not become spies. That was really the thinking at the time. So they waited for him to go back to England to see if he had other contacts to be able to cut other people at the same time. So, but he became aware that he was followed, so he didn't contact any other people. So he was arrested and tried in England and was condemned to 10 years of jail. He's lucky that he was not arrested in the U.S. because in the U.S. people who were caught were sent to a life sentence or even death penalty, some of them. So, and he did a bit less than 10 years and eventually got out of jail, but was not able to find a job in the U.K., but moved to Africa and became a physics professor in Uganda for years. Guzenko had to go undercover because the Soviets were looking for him. So he had to live undercover for the rest of his life. And whenever he appeared in public, it was not Halloween. He was wearing something like this. So when he wrote a book, The Fall of Ititan, and it was something really big in 1946, all these spies. So some historians say that's really the start of the Cold War, when Guzenko came in and really showed that there were really Soviet spies in Canada and in the US also. Another man who probably, almost surely, was another spy is Bruno Pontecorvo. He was never caught and he never said that he was, but a lot of things point to the fact that he probably was. And also Stalin had two different spy systems, if you want, one with the KGB, the other with the army, and probably that Pontecorvo and Nanme didn't know that the other was a spy and they were reporting to different people. Because after the war, Pontecorvo moved to Chalk River. He worked in Chalk River for a couple of years. Then he moved to Harwell in the UK, which is the equivalent of Chalk River in the UK, where most of the research was done. And then in 1950, the Americans found some information that pointed to the fact that perhaps Pontecorvo had been a spy since the 40s. But he heard that, and while he was with his family in Italy during the summer for a vacation, suddenly they disappeared, and nobody heard about them, him and his family, for 5 years. And they reappeared in Moscow in 1955. So now we know all the details, and I talk a bit about that in my book. It's that the Soviets were afraid that perhaps he would be caught and he would speak, so they arranged for a way for him to go to Finland and drive through the border to Russia, and he worked all the rest of his life for Russia, for the Soviets. He was very brilliant. He did many work that was fundamental science, especially on neutrinos, small particles, and he would probably have had the Nobel Physics Prize if he hadn't defected or went to the Soviet. So we see him in near Montreal University during the war, walking with women. He was supposedly, what I read, was very popular with women. And also with Pierre Auger, the other man, which is not Russian, he's French, wearing the hat. He was also a famous physicist from France. He has an effect, the Auger effect, called after him. So when you have an effect called after you, it means you have probably done something as a researcher. I don't know how I'm going time-wise, but I'm nearing the end, so...
You should probably
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, that's it. So just very briefly to see, there were no reactor, they had no idea, you know, how to build a nuclear reactor in Montreal. So they had a lot of engineering problems, not only basic science problems, but engineering problems to solve. Especially on to control the power, remove the heat, etc. So the and that was done during the war at the Montreal lab. They designed two reactors, as we saw. And that was the principal engineer. I will go. I can answer questions on that if needed. And then after the war, what happened to the Montreal lab after the war? It moved to Chalk River, so it's still in existence. Chalk River is the follow-up of the Montreal lab. And the CANDU reactors, the fact that we're using heavy water is a consequence of what happened during the war. There was a scientist in Montreal who wrote a paper during the war pointing out at cobalt-60. It's the first paper saying that cobalt-60 could be used as treatment for cancer. So that's why Canada for a long time was a leader of cancer treatment machines and also radioisotopes until, and I know that now McMaster is still going strong on that and have a bright future, I think, for that. And so also in France, because many researchers from France and the UK came here, so when they went back to France and UK, they started laboratories and there. So we can see here it's Chalk River 1945, so you see two reactors that are under construction. That's the Ottawa River that you can see there in the background, and the other side is the province of Quebec. So the Ottawa River divides Ontario and Quebec. And the white building at the front is the ZEEP, the one that Lev Kovarsky led, that was built under about 13 months. And the big building behind is the NRX. So it was, when it was under construction, it was the biggest reactor in the world. Eventually, it was completed in 1949. And it operated until the 80s. And then after that, the NRX, another one was built just beside the NRU, which was the one that perhaps you have heard about, producing a big amount of radioisotopes. For a long time, Canada was the biggest producer of radioisotopes in the world because of Chalk River, of the NRU reactor, until it was closed in 2017. Now we are still producing, like here in McMaster and other places in Canada, but much smaller amount than we used to. So a lot of the radioisotopes that were produced at NRU are now produced in other countries, in South Korea, Argentina. And here, just for fun, there's a Commissariat à l'énergie atomique. It's the French head of the nuclear research, and we see that three people who worked in Montreal were there. So Pierre Auger, Bertrand Goldschmidt, and Lev Kovarsky. Kovarsky was also head of the first French nuclear reactor called Zoé, Z-O-E. It was a copy, actually, of ZEEP. The first reactor in France was a copy of the first reactor in Canada. And here you can see also Frédéric Joliot-Curie and Irène Curie. So so the French had a big, as you know, a big program now, still almost 80% of their electricity comes from nuclear power plants. So I think that's it for my talk, and I'd like, if you have questions, I'm really happy to answer.
Thank you so much. I'll help with the questions and answers.
Yeah, okay.
And Gilles, I want to say thank you so much. That was a fascinating conversation. One of the best lectures I've witnessed here at a HALSA presentation. and it makes me proud as a Canadian, proud as a person associated with McMaster, to think that people who worked, who came before us, played such an important role in events that are still benefiting us today. And you've done a wonderful job of explaining. And a small gift from our group to you. And I want to ask some questions, or see if there are some questions from our audience. And this is an author of ours from Hamilton we're very proud of.
Thanks.
So we'll take questions from the audience. The way that we do it, because we record these lectures, when there's a question from the audience, I'll repeat it so that it's on the recording, and then you can answer it. Is that okay?
Yes.
Great. So who would like to start with a question? Yes.
How much of the research that was being done by the group in Canada, if any, was directed towards the use of nuclear weapons?
So the question is, how much of the research that was happening with the group in Canada, including the Canadians and those refugees and others who came, was directed toward producing nuclear weapons?
I would say that most of the work was done to regarding nuclear weapons, because during the war you wouldn't fund a project like this if it had no military application. But they knew beforehand, like in 1942 when they moved to Montreal, they knew that they couldn't produce the bomb before the end of the war. They knew that it was a long-term project, but they still decided to do it. But they had in mind that it would have civil applications, like the nuclear reactor, that you must have a nuclear reactor to produce plutonium. So this that has a military application to produce a bomb. But at the same time, you can use the heat generated to produce electricity. So they knew that. So they had the researchers had this in mind. And after the war, the Canadian government could have decided to continue and build a bomb. We had this project, but they made the decision, the government made the decision to continue only to have civil applications. So mainly nuclear reactor for power and also medical applications. Mostly because the Americans already had the bomb and they knew that we would be protected, if we can say so, by the Americans.
Long time ago. Yes. So the question is that we discussed a lot of the American-owned uranium mines in the past. Are there any Canadian uranium mines still in production today?
A lot of things happened during the war. Initially, the Americans bought all the uranium, but during the war, the government nationalized the uranium mines. So at the end of the war, it was owned by the government of Canada. It was eventually sold, but it was owned by Canada. Yes, there are still mines, uranium mines. It's in Saskatchewan. It's owned by a different group. It's not all owned by only one group or one company. So, but Canada has some of the mines, or the mines are partially owned by Canadians, but also by French. A lot of French have assets in Canadian mines.
Another question? Yes, up there, please.
The first reactor was built at Chalk River, and why did they choose Chalk River versus anywhere?
So the question is, the first reactor to be built in Canada was at Chalk River. Why did they choose to build it there?
So they considered several places. When they were doing the research in Montreal, they decided not to build the reactor in the middle of the city. So they said it's better at a remote location. And they looked at different places, like 5-6 different places, and they chose Chalk River because it's remote, but at the same time, not too remote. The Trans-Canada Highway goes nearby, the train, and also there was the Petawawa military base, which is just very close to, so it's easier to protect. So that's the main reason. So they bought, they expropriated the people who owned the land, and they bought everything from zero, you know, build the site and also build the village where everybody, almost everybody was who still working at the site lives. It's Deep River.
Maybe they chose Chalk River because they knew there'd always be good fishing. So how did Canada, the question is, how did Canada get heavy water if all of it was bought, of course, in Norway, as we saw at the beginning?
So when Halban moved from Cambridge to Montreal, he moved also with the 85 kilograms that were taken in Norway. So initially, but it's not enough to build a reactor, but it's enough to do some experiments. So that's what they did. After the Quebec conference, there was an agreement between the Americans and the British, and Canada was allowed to have some heavy water, but the heavy water was actually produced in British Columbia. There was a plant, ammonia plant, the same like Norway, and the Americans contacted them in 1942 saying, what would you say if we build another part of your plant to produce heavy water, and we pay you, and we do everything. So they did that, but they also built two plants in the US. So Canada was allowed to build, to buy a part of the production of the Trail BC plant during the war. And after the war, we built several heavy water plants. There is still one at Darlington. That can, I think it now it doesn't produce, but it can take heavy water from other plants or other reactors and make it ready or concentrate enough to be used again. Not sure exactly the status of the Darlington plant, but.
So at Darlington, it separated tritium from heavy water.
Yes.
Right, so at Darlington, they separate tritium from heavy water, which Jill confirms.
Yeah, when you use heavy water in a nuclear reactor, it's irradiated. It goes in the core of the reactor. So deuterium, if it absorbs a neutron, becomes tritium, which is another isotope of hydrogen. So with one proton and two neutrons. And deuterium is not radioactive. But tritium is, with a half-life, I think, of 7 years? Anyway, a few years, so that it's radioactive long enough and strong enough that you have to treat it. You cannot, and if there's too much tritium in the plant, then it's higher, it's for the workers, it's more dangerous.
Probably time for one more question, and then I know that Gilles will be able to answer some questions up front while he's signing some books. Yes, go ahead. So the very good question. The question is, it begins with the statement that the American scientific community was very divided about the propriety of developing a bomb. The morals and ethical questions divided that group. Was there similar division among Canadians working in the Montreal lab?
I'm really happy with the question. It's yes, and there was the same thing in Montreal. In the US, there was a group of scientists who were working for the Manhattan Project, started a kind of petition of letter that was circulated and signed by some people, and they were even able to have the scientific committee. They proposed something different. Instead of dropping that was before Hiroshima, that was in June and July 1945. Instead of dropping the bomb on Hiroshima, they suggested to drop it on a desert island to show the Japanese the impact, but not on people. And it was taken to the highest scientific committee, where Fermi was sitting and other people, and the decision was not to drop it on a desert island. Anyway, even if the scientific committee had decided that it would be a good idea, it was in the hands of the military. The last decision was not done by scientists. And in Montreal, there was a similar, I discovered that only last year. Someone sent me a letter that they found in their father's papers, that a similar letter was circulated in Montreal by one of the gentlemen of the chemistry division. And it was, and it was not exactly the same one that, the one that was in the Manhattan Project is public, and these people also started the atomic scientist, and the atomic scientist bulletin in the United States, the people who, you know, the clock, the doomsday clock, I don't know if you heard about it. It's these people who were working for the Manhattan Project who started that after the war, saying we're close to a nuclear war. And in Montreal, something similar happened, but nobody published about it. So that's an idea I have, to write an article, but I would like to find the name of people who signed that. The letter, I have the name of only two. So I guess that there were more than that. But yes, there were similar questioning.
Thank you, Jill. I should point out, as you probably know, and many others here probably do, that the circle was in a way closed in a poetic fashion when Robert Oppenheimer came here to McMaster to give a 3-day lecture. By then, he was a very controversial figure, but those lectures were sold out and well-attended and highly covered and very important. So that whole community, once divided, mm-hmm. Did come together nicely. And I just want to say that it's not common to find someone who knows science so deeply, complex science, and explains it so well. And we're all lucky to have heard a conversation or a presentation so serious, so deep, so substantial, but also so comprehensible. Mm-hmm. And congratulations, and thank you very much for that as well.